gathered together from the cosmic reaches of the universe, here in this great hall of justice.
Superheroes have to be around other superheroes. You know what I mean? That's the Hall of Justice is more about them just commiserating about their powers and less about them, like, actually fighting crime.
Seth Everett is the best there is at what he does, bub. And what he does is the Hall of Justice podcast.
Go, go, go with a smile.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Hall of Justice. This is episode 245. Thank you for downloading. Thank you for subscribing. And please, if I ask you one thing today, and our guest asks you one thing today, rate and review and say that this episode is your favorite one. See if that happens. See what happens. And let's see if iTunes markets podcasts just based on your ratings and reviews. We are going to revisit something that we haven't talked about since June. And that is the fantastic animated film from Warner Brothers and DC Universe. And that is Batman: The Long Halloween. When the first part of this film came out, we spoke to the writer, Tim Sheridan, who wrote part two as well. And what he did was he gushed about the voice cast. He kept saying, oh my God, you have to talk to some of these voice casts. And then once the part two came out and I got a chance to see part two, there's really nobody else that we really need to talk to other than our guest today. She has been in a number of animated properties. She's also been in live action properties, but for the purposes of this and you nerds out there, let's face it, she was in Spider-Man, the new animated series, which is not that new anymore, but it was on MTV. She was Ro on the Zeta Project, and she plays Gilda Dent on Batman: The Long Halloween. Ladies and gentlemen of the Hall of Justice, please welcome the great Julie Nathanson. Julie, welcome.
Hi, thank you. What a lovely welcome.
Well, the intros on this podcast are great. Everything else, let's face it, it goes downhill from here.
Yeah, but that's okay. I mean, I'm easily excited by sparkles. So, beginning with that kind of glitter, I won't notice anything that has sort of a duller texture. So we should be fine.
All right, very good. We'll pretend for the first like 10 minutes that people are just hearing this for you. But I will say that we're going to have some spoilers at some point, because let's face it, how do you review something properly and not give spoilers? The movie is out on digital. It's also coming out on Blu-ray, and you play Harvey Dent's wife. What did you know about it? You had done some superhero stuff before. What did you know about the project before you got it?
Well, having existed in the DC universe prior to this, I certainly had heard of Batman: The Long Halloween. I knew that it was beloved. I knew that it was, you know, beyond a fan favorite. It was, you know, pivotal in the canon. And I did have some sense of why, but I had never read the graphic novel or the collection. So I knew it was a big deal, and I didn't know the full story, but I had a general sense of the gist. I did not know really anything about Gilda, but I knew enough to be really excited. I knew enough about what I was getting into to know that it was a big deal. And it honestly took me one reading of the script to fall madly in love with it.
It really is. There's a number of potential villains, and you know it goes in very DC like, in that there's a million red herrings, and there, you know, you never know what it is, and a good chunk of the audience is not going to have read that book. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's something about comic books. You know, comic books are kind of fading as there's animation and live action and seemingly something new every week. A lot of people are seeing this story for the first time, don't you think?
I do. And I guess perhaps it's a naive position, but it surprises me to hear you say that comic books are dying, because I guess I look at sort of the symbiotic relationship between the moving pictures and the written word. So, you know, I think people who watch this movie might then become interested in reading, you know, the original story. But again, that might be my overly enthusiastic and sparkly naivete. But I love the fact that, you know, we're able to tell stories in so many different forms of media now.
Oh, completely. I just think that, you know, when I was growing up, and, you know, you never ask a lady how old she is, but when I was growing up, there was a smattering of animation. I mean, I grew up, the Super Friends existed. That's why we called this show The Hall of Justice. The itch that was scratched was from books. And it seems like the books that were written in the 80s and early 90s became classics. Mm-hmm. Whereas today, it's every week there's something from Marvel, there's something from DC, there's something from Star Wars, there's something from this, you know, and then all the creators got smart and they started creating independently things. So you have Invincible and all of these different things that are coming out. So you can be a comic book fan and never touch a comic book.
That's such a great point. I guess I'm just such an appreciator of, again, abundance, you know, so many stories, so many ways of telling stories. And then there is, an unfortunate reality, which is that we are each, as far as we know, only one person. So I constantly
as
lament.
As far as we know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, listen.
You're talking about a multiverse in real life?
I'm talking about a multiverse. I'm talking about clones. I mean, we can talk about this if you want.
Yeah, who's the president in the multiverse?
That is classified information. I went there. Sure. No, it's fine. And I'll AI my way through any conversation if I have to. Uh-huh. I guess that is the conundrum, isn't it? Like what to watch and what to allow yourself to become absorbed into, you know, at the risk of eclipsing all of the other phenomenal, you know, content out there. But yes. There's a lot. I love it. And there's too much for all of us to be able to consume, certainly at once or in one lifetime or multiverse.
Yeah.
Or cloning.
Cloning too. Wow.
I don't know, Seth.
You have read a lot of scripts. Wow.
I might have read a lot of scripts. It's good. It's great. I don't get them mixed up. Are you a Smurf?
No. So is this something you always wanted to do? Acting, that is. Was this something that you said, you know, when you went to school, you said, you know, I want to get on screen or on a stage or something. And, you know, I guess it's a two-pronged thing, is how do you then make the transition to voice? Or did you skip the whole thing and 90210 was an accident?
I think more A than B.
Yeah. I had a hunch.
It's hard for a 90210 to be an accident. You know, that was such a wild experience, going from being basically a fan of the show to being on the show. But yes, going back into the history, let me start the story at the day I was born. The first time I remember being on stage, I was 6 years old. I'm not going to take you through my entire life experience.
Oh, but okay. Please tell me your fourth grade teacher.
The origins. Well, my fourth grade teacher was Mr. Bauer. Okay. He was great. So I remember in first grade, we were doing some presentation for the parents. I remember my parents sitting in the audience in folding chairs. I remember looking out at the audience from a little crack in the curtain. And I remember that I was going to be in some scene with this other kid, and the other kid did not show up. And I remember his name was Jimmy. And I remember that
maybe he subscribes to this podcast. Maybe we can go find him.
Jimmy. Well, listen, Jimmy not showing up that day. Yeah. You know, I should thank you, Jimmy. So Jimmy didn't show up that day. And Jimmy was supposed to be the weatherman. Right. We didn't, We didn't say weather person at the time. It was always weather man. And he didn't show up and he had to begin the whole thing. And I just threw on the blazer that he had that was supposed to be backstage, whatever kind of stage you have when you're six.
Yep.
And threw my long hair up into a little bun and went on stage and without even thinking about it, just did all of his lines and just performed as him. And the, I think I played opposite myself, but that's odd to remember. What I remember is that I had accidentally memorized all of his lines and I had been so excited about the entire performance that it was all in my mind and in my body to perform it. And that is my first memory of being a performer. And, you know, my family would tell you that, you know, I would, you know, try to make everybody laugh, or I would, you know, perform little skits and all the things that, you know, go along with being a probably overly excitable, passionate, performative child. but I really did love performance, and I came from, you know, a family where, you know, academics were also super important. So, you know, it wasn't like, okay, this is my only path. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to finish high school, or I'm not going to go to college. That was sort of, those two were foregone conclusions. So I moved through all of my schooling, still knowing that I did want to perform. And I was also writing at the time too in school. I was, you know, I won the Philadelphia Young Playwrights Festival when I was a senior in high school. Like, so I was really involved.
So you're a Philly person.
I am a Philly person.
Nice. We're coming to you live from New Jersey.
You are? Where in New Jersey?
Well, I grew up in central New Jersey, but I live now in kind of northern, kind of Essex County now.
Yep. And did you hear Philly, how excited Philly people I got
get
about
it? I know. Philly people get my one of my favorite Twitter things that ever happened, happened to Philadelphia. I joined Twitter in 2009. And in 2011, I worked for the Phillies. So at the really? Time, like, 80% of my following was Philadelphia. And the one thing Philadelphia people think is that if you work for one of their teams, you must love all of their teams. I can't stand the Philadelphia Flyers. And I remember we had a newborn and we went to the mall to push the stroller, you know, so she'd fall asleep. And it was, you know, middle of January and it's freezing cold outside. And we went for a walk in the mall. And the Devils are playing the Flyers, and the Devils are winning like 5-0 after two periods. And all I tweeted was, every one of these goals feels great. And I got, you're a traitor. You're one of us. You're not Philadelphia. So I love Philadelphia. Philadelphia, not so much with me.
I will happily tell you that I will be the exception to that rule. You seem delightful so far. and you know, your sports teams are not, you know, the only criterion upon which I judge my friends. So no, yes. I think we're good, Seth. I think we're good.
Very nice. when did the first voice option come along? Is it something where you said, boy, that sounds fun? Or is it something where somebody saw you for something, because you have a unique voice and you could probably do dozens of different voices? I mean, I've heard all your work, so I know you can do all this different work. And that's a range that not everybody has and not every actor has.
Thank you. That's a lovely thing to say. So again, back to, so the origin story, right? It never really occurred to me that voice acting could be a full career path. You know, I certainly have colleagues who knew that's what they wanted to do. They watched the cartoons and they said, I want that to be me. I don't think it ever even occurred to me. I knew that I wanted to be a performer. I did, you know, stage, I did television, I did film. I was very lucky. I worked, you know, very, very quickly after undergraduate school. And I was working on, it was actually on a soap at the time, but for some reason, I was in Los Angeles because I think I was maybe doing 90210. I can't remember.
Are you
but
talking
I was out
about
there.
Another world?
Yeah, but why in the chronology did you know that was the soap?
Well, first of all, this is the first time Another World has ever been mentioned on this podcast. And second of all, because I did some homework.
Wow. I'm impressed. New Jersey. Listen to you. Okay. So, So at the time I was doing a little work on Another World, and I think that was probably the one. But anyway, I was curious, either for that or a different soap, I wanted to know what the fans thought. Because see, Seth, this was before anybody said don't read the comments. And this, because it was back in the day, and I'll give you a different, older.
I already love this story.
Right. There was this thing you could do. You could go onto your computer and you could turn it on, and then magically people all over the world could talk to you. I was like, all right, well, I want to see what the fans think of me. And so I went on, you know, like old school message board. Yep. And this is the quote that I found. So, quote, "She's real pretty and all, but I have to turn the volume off on my TV because it's like Alvin and the Chipmunks have invaded my living room."
Oh no.
And can we curse on this show or not?
Yes, you can. You can.
Okay. So my reaction internally was like, first of all, fuck you. Second of all, that sounds like a great career. And it had actually never occurred to me that, yes, I mean, especially when I'm not trying to monitor my voice to talk to you, so I am not so screechy. You know, at the time I was like, hey, hi, I'm Julie. How are you? What are we doing? And very cartoony in my, what I felt was sort of my optimal pitch and natural voice. I knew I had an unusual voice, but it never occurred to me until someone called it a curse that it could be a blessing. So at the time I was already represented by CESD, which is where I'm still represented for voice acting all these years later. And I was repped there for on-camera commercials. And I called up my agents back in New York. And I said, hey, can I meet with the voiceover department? Like, I've been trained as an actor forever. And, you know, I'm trained actually as a classical singer. I probably know what to do with my voice. And I don't know, can you try me out on this voiceover thing? Can I have a meeting with the agents? We all sat down. And they said, okay. And, you know, I was so lucky to already be represented when this, you know, became a fledgling concept to my little brain. But I went on my first audition, and this is my kids don't try this at home thing. I booked it. And it was like a year's worth of work doing promos for Lifetime Television.
Nice.
Which was like The Dish, The Wire, Pandora, Three Blind Dates, The Place on Lifetime, Come As You Are. And that paid my rent for a year. And I was like, this is great. And it also, you know, I'm pretty mushy as a person. So I've already talked about sparkles and things. I'm sure rainbows will come up at some point. But like, I felt like I was home. Like I hit the microphone and I felt calm and comfortable and free. You know, at the time, you know, I was definitely, I would say, limited by the way I might be seen visually. No one was going to think of me as a soldier. No one was going to think of me as a villain. No one was going to think of me as a giant creature. And so I didn't think of me as capable of those things. But there was something permissive about the microphone. And it unlocked a space for me that on camera never did.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And, you know, the interesting part about it is you did it in a time when podcasts didn't exist and Twitch didn't exist and those things didn't exist. And you seized something, you seized a comfortability, and it's really fascinating. One of the early things that you wound up doing though was Batman Beyond.
Yeah.
And one of the greatest shows ever. I mean, ever. Literally one of the fantastic pieces of art, you know, ever. And you played Ro, who was buddies with Zeta. And then they did the spinoff, the Zeta Project, that no one talks about. And it was a great show. And it took place in the future. How did that all come about?
That was, so the Zeta Project, if memory serves, I think I was cast on the Zeta Project first. I think the crossover episode of Batman Beyond that I was on, I think we did partway through the Zeta project. I think Zeta had already appeared on Batman Beyond. And then I think we did another episode where I appeared, if memory serves. What I can tell you is that it was maybe a year plus after I had moved from New York to Los Angeles. I was working with CESD out here. And Kathy Lizzio, who is still at CESD, knew how much I wanted to work in animation. I actually remember that when I first got out to Los Angeles, I had my commercial reel, my demo. I had my, you know, very cute little, you know, pay less shoes, you know, whatever it was I wanted to be selling everyone. And I had nothing for animation. And I remember she and I, you know, went into the booth together. And she had me just write up things that I could, you know, say and do in character voices. And we just made this like dry demo so I would have something to show. And, you know, she started sending me on auditions. And I actually remember that it was my birthday when she called me to tell me that I booked the Zeta Project.
But never you were not 15. Like she's.
I was not 15.
You were playing a 15.
I was still.
Year old, you were
pretty,
a grown.
I was
grown,
still pretty young.
Adult.
But I was a drinkable adult. Sir, the subject of your sentence is fraught. I was still young at the time and very excited. What I can tell you about that story is that I went in. To audition for a role on Static Shock. I was there, they handed me this other role that they were, you know, working on casting at the same time. And I actually still have the character art from the original.
Oh,
audition.
That's so cool.
I have it framed.
So it's funny that you mentioned Static Shock because, you know, when Static Shock came out, I was traveling with a baseball team. Like I didn't have time. It wasn't I was against Static Shock. It was you had Batman, you had Superman, you had Justice League, you had this, you had Spider-Man, you had X-Men. How much could you do? And I was constantly VHSing everything because I was traveling all over the place and I couldn't keep up. So I skipped Static Shock. And when HBO Max came out, it was one of the first shows that I found. And I'm watching Static Shock this year like it's the first time. And Phil Lamar, who's been on this podcast before, does such an amazing job changing voices on that. I just want for the audience, HBO Max, if you can find Static Shock, it's brilliant and brilliantly done.
I love that you're experiencing it for the first time.
As a 47-year-old human being.
Yeah, it's really, it's a phenomenal show. And you're right, Phil is... He's just, first of all, a beautiful human being and ridiculously talented. And it was really fun to see him, you know, work on that show and be as excited about it as everyone else. And, you know, now his career just is, you know, I mean, his breadth of characters is pretty stunning. So, yes, that was the original audition was for Static Shock, I believe. And they handed me Roe and said, "Oh, we're doing this other thing. Awesome. Can you read this?" And I remember Bob Goodman was there in the room or across the glass. If memory serves there, we had a little East Coast connection. But I just instantly found Roe. Like she came to me on the page, right? I just feel like, oh, this is who she is. It wasn't even a question. I don't even think I like had to really think about like who is she and where it just kind of happened. It was just one of those really organic spaces.
And one last thing on Zeta Project. Mm-hmm. This was done during the time when they were recording as a radio play with everyone in the booth.
It was the best.
And think about who was on this show. This is the Zeta. Diedrich Bader, who's been on this podcast. Michael Rosenbaum, who's been on this podcast. Lauren Tom, who's been on this podcast. But she was Julie on Friends. Mm-hmm. George Siegel was Pops on the Goldbergs and just recently passed away. Hal Linden was Barney Miller. I mean, this is a who's who that you're hanging out with.
Yeah, the main cast was really a wonderful bonding experience.
Diedrich Rosenbaum, one of the nicest human beings on earth.
Yeah, Diedrich and I have stayed friends over the years. He is a truly glorious human being with a huge heart. I was so new and young at the time, and I actually found our sessions to be kind of a grounding force in my life. You know, again, I was new to LA, and I was, you know, pretty new to the animation scene anyway. And we just, I don't know, it was such a bonded cast. And I've seen fans say, when they see us talk about it, like we all talk about it like it's this romantic experience, like, oh yes, back in the day, and we all just loved each other. But it was really fun, and it was really great. And Kurtwood Smith, oh, I just love him.
Yeah.
And
Kurtwood Smith played out. He was one of the agents. Played,
yeah, I mean, so it was a time, and Andrea Romano was our director, and you know what an amazing director to have for my first series regular on a cartoon. You know, I remember so many of the guest stars, you know, like I remember Demi Coleman coming in. I was so starstruck when Lorraine Newman
working
came
9 to 5.
In. 9 to 5 and Lorraine Newman.
And Tootsie.
There were just so, yes. And there were so many fantastic guest stars. And, you know, it really was a time. And of course, you know, oh, I just wanted to keep doing more animation. So I feel really lucky that I'm still doing it.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. One other project before we get into the long Halloween. And really what I've done is I've given people ample time. If you pause this podcast, see the goddamn movie already, because I'm spoiling the bejesus out of it. I'm just telling you. And that is the MTV Spider-Man show.
Yes. That was a trip. And also, you know, Neil Patrick Harris, played Spider-Man. He was a wonderful Spider-Man. And Lisa Loeb was our Mary Jane.
Yep.
And Ian Ziering was on the show as well. And he was Harry. And you know, he and I sat in the room together, and I was like, hey, do you remember I was on your show? So we had been, you know, we'd worked together a little bit on 90210, and also, you know, he had been one of the members of the cast that I really spent the most time talking to. So it was really delightful. But, you know, Neil Patrick Harris was, I really think he did a fantastic job in that role. And then just this past year, I did a show that's on Netflix right now. It's a 4-episode anime called Eden. And although Neil and I were not in the same room, because here we are, we're still in this sort of semi-lockdown world.
Yep.
And we didn't even get to play off of each other, you know, during our recordings, but we were opposite each other in this series.
That's cool.
And it was, and you know, that's a beautiful series too. I really am. I'm proud of that. The work we all did, and really just, honored to be a part of it. It's a really special little series. So, but yes, working with Neil Patrick Harris and Lisa Loeb, who's such a doll, and you know, again, just another like pinch me, I can't believe I'm here situation.
But it was like a Marvel universe beforehand, because this series tied into the Tobey Maguire movies, but also Michael Clark Duncan, who was Kingpin in the Ben Affleck Daredevil, was Kingpin in this. And it was like, it was the origin of these things. Like they did this in the 90s, Marvel did. And you saw the beginning of this one character from a different property interacting with another. And you could see the seeds of it being built to what it is now, where everything is serial in nature.
I love that you have put all of these things together.
And 245 it's episodes. What do you think we talk about?
Well, you know, that's a pretty big number. Congratulations. Thanks for having things to talk about with me.
No, really.
I mean, you know, I love the perspective, you know, that you have, having put all of these things together and seeing how, you know, each of these stories or iterations of stories, you know, help create the tapestry, right, of this universe.
Well said. Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating in that there is, you could tell by this point in time in 2003 that stuff was being designed by fans.
Mm.
And that's the thing about today's stuff. I mean, and we talked about this at length with Tim Sheridan, who wrote The Long Halloween. Just the idea that, you know, in the 70s, you didn't have you didn't have writers who were lifelong superhero fans. That didn't exist. You know, superheroes were for kids. And once you grew up, you were supposed to give them up. And and nowadays you have people who are fans for life. So when you watch something like The Mandalorian or you know, if you see The Long Halloween, you can tell by the writing in The Long Halloween that they grew up with Batman, that they are lifelong fans of this product. And I think it's why the quality of stuff has increased in modern times, because of the idea that these people grew up on Spider-Man, the animated series, and Batman Beyond and things like that. And they've taken that passion and brought it to what they have today.
I think that's absolutely right. Because the thing that I've been noticing is the passion of the creators. You know, I know you want to talk about Long Halloween and you know, even just mentioning Tim, his writing in this is so stunning to me. And I've communicated with him. And at this point, like, I kind of feel like I might be a fan at this point. Like, I can't stop telling him how much I love that script. But you can tell his passion is so clear. And looking at, you know, just the vision, you know, talking to Butch and that noir look, just the way the animation plays, it feels so simultaneously like it's paying homage to the stories that we grew up on and the feeling of those stories, the feeling we had reading or watching those stories, as well as this like new experience and telling of the story, and in a cinematic way, in a way that feels like if you close your eyes, it could be live action. And to me, that's part and parcel to really what you're saying, which is growing up with these things and keeping them in the creators' souls and hearts as they are either forming new stories or adapting old stories. Yeah. You know, that is coming from a place of passion, connection, and knowledge and respect. And it's the respect that gets me, like taking it seriously, taking, you know, when people, you know, I love talking to newer voice actors who are just starting or are aspiring. And it's always, you know, like, well, what's the secret to a long career? And I'm just like, it's joy. You know, it's holding on to gratitude and joy and passion for this, not just because it sounds like a great motivational poster, but because it is a return to play and it is taking play seriously, right? And that is, to me, the crux. And again, like, why was the microphone this, you know, portal for me into a state of performative freedom? Well, it gave me the room to play. You know, if as an on-camera actor, I would be given, you know, here are your three costumes, most of them skimpy. And this is what you can wear for, how strange could that be? So, you know, and this is who you'll be, right? These are the characters you're allowed to play and that's it, which tells me this is all I am, right? But at the microphone, you know, no costumes here, but also, you know, it's whatever comes out of my voice. It's whatever comes out of my head. It's whatever is on the page that I can challenge myself to attempt. And that is playing in a much larger sandbox, you know? And I think that's also what, you know, the writers, producers, animators, creators, musicians who are working on these projects get to do. They get to return to this state of wild play before anybody says, you're just this one thing. You know, when we're five, when we're six, when we're seven, and we're playing and we're doing dress up or we're doing some sort of fantasy game or we're just running around on the playground, nobody's really telling us, you know, sweetheart, you really just have to stay this one thing. I'm going to be a ferocious creature. Okay, roar. And that's fine. Right. But as we get older, we're given these instructions around how to limit ourselves or how to siphon ourselves into just one category. And it takes another lifetime, it feels like sometimes, to open that up again and say, wait a minute, I get to decide that. And I think this return to, you know, the thing that brought us into a state of play is I just think you're totally right, is part of what is catalyzing this really wild time in animation, where the stories are being told in a different way and with so much passion, and not to say that there wasn't passion before, but there is something different about this time. It's pretty incredible to be a part of it, I have to tell you.
Well,
really,
one of the things that we try to do on this podcast, you know, over the past, you know, years that we've been doing it, is make sure it's for grownups. We make sure that it's not a nerd podcast. It's a, you know, that was the slogan behind the Hall of Justice is, if you're old enough to know what the Hall of Justice is, you're a demographic. And that was the whole idea behind starting it. And that was why we named it that, because we wanted it to have that kind of context, you know? Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're going to be doing, because Tim Sheridan recommended it, we were talking about, you know, he's very, very outspoken and very open about his homosexuality. That's something mm-hmm. he wants to talk about. Mm-hmm. But he brought up that Transformers, which is something that was just released on Netflix, mm-hmm. and that he also co-wrote, and he has scheduled me to interview his co-writer, this young lady named May Catt. Mm-hmm. And supposedly, and this is something like, again, I'm in my 40s. I have no idea, but Transformers has a huge following in the LGBTQ community because of the whole idea of robots in disguise. Hmm. I was like, what in the world? Like, there is so much depth to this stuff. That if you see some guy in the mall wearing an Autobot shirt or a Batman shirt, that doesn't mean that he's immature.
Oh,
there
no.
is a lot of maturity around here. That's we're going to focus on that in a couple of weeks in a future episode of the podcast. But just the idea that that's something that exists that I never would have even considered.
Well, so I love hearing that, and to me, it's also part of why my perspective is that almost all art, I mean, I'm sure there's an exception, but is collaborative by nature. You know, even if you're an artist creating something in the middle of the desert, the minute one person sees it, it's a collaboration, because mm-hmm. that other person is taking meaning, having a reaction, interpreting something from it, having a feeling inspired by it. And that's collaborative, because that's a new way that art is living. And the things that we all do, you know, to create these stories is collaborative by nature. Someone's like, oh, you're Gilda. And I'm like, yes, I voice Gilda, you know, and I don't always make the correction, but you know, it's, yeah, I have one part to play in this movie. Well, okay, I have a couple of little ones too, but
there's 8,000 characters in this, and you play a central character.
But it's also that there are 8,000 people working on it. There are artists, there are editors, there are producers, there are writers, and you know, the people who are recording it, and the number of people who touch each project is always more than one might imagine, and you know the same can be true for how we all interpret what we see. You know, countless people are going to watch each cartoon, each movie, and play each game and have their own interpretation and their own reaction. And so because art is, you know, always by nature subject to interpretation, and therefore to me personally collaborative,
sure.
You know, that the idea that, yeah, the guy in the mall who's wearing, I almost dropped my water on myself, but I didn't. You didn't see it,
yeah,
but it was pretty.
We wouldn't
deft.
Know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely saved it. Mm-hmm. But I want you all to know that I didn't spill my water all over myself.
I'm leaving that in. I'm not taking that out.
Oh, no, you should never take it out. No, okay. I will tell you here and now, I am a clumsy person, which is why I'm really proud of the fact that I am not covered in ice water right now. But the guy, you know, the guy in the mall who's wearing the Batman shirt, you know, could have myriad reasons why he's wearing it.
Right.
You know, it could be that, you know, he loved the comic books. It could be that, you know, somebody called him
one of these movies.
Or it could be that somebody called him Batman because they felt like, you know, sometimes he might have had,
yeah,
or that he had a couple of different identities. You know, you sort of don't know. And now that I think, you know, it is more acceptable to love these stories and to love superheroes and supervillains, and the stories that made them, I think it's just broadening for so many people. Again, this experience of tapping into play as grownups, which I think is a really important thing for us to do.
I couldn't agree with you more. Although as a father, I failed miserably, because before my kids were old enough to see the Star Wars movies, we got them this really cute book called Vader's Little Princess. And it's a story. It's a bunch of skits about how Leia is like a teenage girl who constantly is getting scolded by her dad, who happens to be Darth Vader. And so when I tried to get my oldest, who's 13 now, but she was probably like 6 or 7, and I said, we should watch Star Wars. And she said, how could Darth Vader be a bad guy? He's such a good father.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
I said, we're done. People yeah. are online, do you show them, you know, episode 4 first? Do you do episode 1? It doesn't matter. She thinks Darth Vader's a good guy, and it's going to throw the whole thing off.
Wow. That is quite a pickle.
Yeah, it's big. We're going to start them over. I'm going to send them the Disney's Plus subscription when they go off to college. Start over.
Yeah.
All right. We've gone long enough. The long Halloween. Gilda does it. I mean, holy moly, Gilda does it. But my question to you is, because of all the pomp and circumstance, you have the mob story, you have every supervillain going, and in the book, it was a monthly story. So the book had the Mad Hatter 1 month and the Scarecrow 1 month and Two-Face and this one and that one and the Joker and the Penguin and all of these. Is Gilda's story properly fleshed out in your opinion?
In the film?
Yes,
I mean,
in
general?
In the film.
I mean, that's a yes, but that's to me because I inhabited her. I mean, I know that sounds very artiste of me, but with these characters, you know, over the past couple of years, I've been able to play some characters who have even more depth and traumatic histories and a lot more going on. And Gilda's one of them. So for me, she was just very real. So it's so interesting. The question has thrown me off because
the idea that, you know, as Batman's figuring it out, mm-hmm, and as Harvey's going through his transformation, mm-hmm, and you have the mob story, mm-hmm, I don't need Mad Hatter and Scarecrow and this one and that one and this one. And what it is it's visual porn. I mean, it's colorful. it is fascinating. And there's so much. The thing about this movie that is different than, you know, a lot of the crap that I watch is I can't work while I'm watching it. You know, mm-hmm, what I mean? Like, you're staring at this. Mm-hmm. This is something like you're focused on all of it. And I feel like there's this massive crescendo. And then Gilda has that meeting at the end with, mm-hmm, Batman. Mm-hmm. And I want Gilda there. You know what I'm saying? I want her watching this. I wanted more of her. I guess partly that's just your performance, but partly it's like you want her to be the middle of this so that you start to feel it. Because the audience is tricked very brilliantly by, it could be the mobster's daughter. It could be all these different people, but she's constantly there. You know, in the carnival when the Joker, you know, throwing all the mm-hmm, whatever that green dust thing is, whatever he sends, you know, the poison, whatever it is, she's there on the side. And what I wanted her to take at the end is more of a greater role towards the end. It was just you know, food for thought.
Well, there was a compliment you threw in there, so I'll say thank you first. And you know, it never occurred to me to feel like, oh, there should have been more Gilda. That may also be part of my collaboratively minded way of doing things. And also that would sort of presuppose that at least for my experience, that, you know, you need to see everything that's going on to feel it. And I'm not sure that I agree with that part.
Okay.
You know, to me, you know, there's such a fine line. It does feel like a live action film. It does feel like it's paying homage to, you know, of course, the source material, of course, the original story, of course, to some beloved animated films and live action. I don't know that, especially because Gilda's inner world is so quiet and so tortured and so depressed and so traumatized.
Yes.
I don't know, other than heightening her, Seth, right? Mm. Which then elevates her to this extra energetic level of villain or hero, right?
Right.
Without doing that to her, you're sort of changing the energy of the film to then really focus on seeing her in each of these moments, and it becomes her story, which, you know, they say like each character is the, you know, the center of their own universe, the protagonist in their own story, as are we, which is actually a great point, right? My experience voicing her was she was a whole person to me. So I know what her inner life was. You know, I knew what she was thinking the whole time. But did the audience have to be let in? I'm not sure. Listen, if Tim wants to like throw down some kind of like, you know, other iteration and we work, I am all over it, guys. Like I love Gilda. She's a very complex character. She was a true honor to play. I didn't feel like I didn't get enough to do. And in watching the film, I don't know. I mean, so many of those twists and turns that you so correctly cited were so brilliantly, you know, woven and hidden.
Right.
You know, the more you focus on the people that have the secrets, the less the secrets are surprising. So I don't know. I would love to know more about her. And if the movie left you wanting to know more, maybe that's a good thing.
Well, that's right. That's why, you know, I didn't, it's not like, I'm going to take this out of the podcast. I wasn't trashing the movie by any stretch.
Oh, no.
Hold on. 3, 2, 1. No, I think that it is, it's interesting to see, because I think in the beginning of part one, you don't think it's her at all, and you wonder where her arc is going, and by the end you suspect it, but then they throw out, you know, all these other potentials, and that it's very dense, and dense in a positive. There's a lot to unpack, and it's a great film that you'll want to see often. And I think the interesting part also about it is you see Batman realizing that part of the job that he's created for himself is as a detective. And that's something that the audience knows, but he doesn't know.
Which is so, again, so beautifully depicted visually by giving it this noir feeling. And that, you know, just dovetails. And, you know, his realization and, you know, and transformation, which in this story is, you know, just more the evolution of who Batman is becoming, you know, mixed with the more stark origin story for Mr. Two-Face. You know, those things, that dichotomy is so exciting to watch. And, you know, yeah, I definitely feel like this film is special. You know, I've been voicing characters for quite a while. And at this point,
we didn't acknowledge you were Silver Banshee in the Suicide Squad animated movie.
I was Suicide Squad Hell to Pay. I loved playing Silver Banshee. A little different from Gilda. A little different. Yep. Definitely a louder character with her sonic scream.
And they're doing a lot more with Silver Banshee in live action. She was on Supergirl.
Silver Banshee is such a, I mean, she's a really interesting character. Oh, my Siobhan. Having been doing this a little while, I'll share with my family if something cool's coming out, but I'm not, you know, calling my mom every time to say, you know, oh, come watch this thing. In the beginning, it was like, Mom, go to your TV. I'm on a show. Now, you know.
Yeah, but now, and I saw you on social media, you're like, I can't tell you anything, but I'm recording something and it's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very, well, that, I mean, that, the whole life of NDAs, I live in terror of breaking them. I am the person who legitimately, and I have said this in interviews before, I have had nightmares about breaking NDAs. I had a nightmare that a particular journalist, games journalist, called me up and tricked me into saying who I was in a game before I had been announced. And I woke up like in a complete panic, heart racing, sweating, like, oh my God, thank God that was a nightmare. Oh, that was terrible. And like, that was just the worst. So I live in terror of NDAs. So yeah, I can't talk about anything, but things that have not come out yet. But I did.
But that's a cool feeling. We've had a bunch of voice people on, and it just seems like that's one of the most fun things to have to say on a podcast or in an interview of any kind. Writers do it too all the time. They're like, "Yeah, I'm busy. I just can't tell you what I'm doing." And what it's not a narcissistic thing, but it must be such a great soothing of the ego, you know?
Oh, that's so, I have to tell you, Seth, I don't have that experience. I'm so sorry. I love that perspective on it. And if other people get joy out of it, fantastic. For me.
Oh, there was a guy, Victor Dandridge, who does a lot of our reviews. He does a lot of our movie reviews, and he's a big part of the podcast. And he's working on something, and he signed an NDA, and he goes, I couldn't tell you. And I said, how much fun was that? Just saying that you couldn't tell me.
I mean, I think there's, look, I mean, there's definitely the
you're a veteran of the business, though. You've had this world before.
I have. It's that you've talked to me for a little while now. I am trying very hard to contain my general enthusiasm and bubbliness. Like, I want to explode with excitement about so many projects. And the fact that I can't talk about them is actually tougher than it sounds. And it's also frustrating. Like, I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, oh yeah, I wish I could tell Seth. Oh, Seth might really dig that. I can't talk about that yet. Oh, you know, nope. That has not been, has that been announced? No, I don't think it has. Oh, better double check. And so I want to talk about the projects because I love what I do. Yeah, so can't talk about those things. Wait, I lost the tangent. What was the thread? Why were we talking NDAs?
No, what you were saying
about. Oh, my mom. Wait, we were talking about my mom. So I said to my mom and stepdad for the first time in so long, hey, I want you to see this one. I want you to see Batman the Long Halloween. And so they absolutely loved it. And
awesome.
My stepdad is someone who
that's
loves
so movies, rewarding.
Like,
yeah.
Godfather and like, you know, those sort of the crime family stuff. And he really loved it. And this is not usually his jam. And I mean, it was just so fun to share it with my family. But if that's any indication of, you know, I guess my honesty, when I say that I love this film, like it was so special to me that I wanted to make sure my family saw it.
It's a special skill to be able to do mafia stuff and not make it cliche.
Right.
And it fits here because a lot of times, you know, in the books, there was always the Falcones and the Maronis and, you know, organized crime was always a big deal. But in, you know, film and TV and the show Gotham had to deal with this all the time. And it's you're like, wait a minute, but there's superheroes and supervillains and, you know, guys that can with exploding gas balls and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And it's just that you walk a fine line and it totally fits the theme of this whole thing. Like I said, you have to see it to believe it. It's the overwhelming threads throughout this entire film. And what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, is it's going to be re-released as a long feature, which will be amazing.
That is above my pay grade. That is not information to which I am currently privy, but that sounds great.
Well, I read it on the internet, so it has to be true.
I mean, I hope that people love it as much as they have shared with me. I track some of the stuff. I love to see what, you know, fans are saying, because, you know, I started my career by reading the comments. So why stop now? Comments have been really lovely.
I had to ask you about social media, because every time I ask this question to someone who's come on a podcast of mine, they always have a different answer. So it's an amazing, amazing thing. But social media, is it something that you find can enhance your craft? Does it get in the way? And given the fact that you're a lovely lady, women have a very different perspective on social media than men do, and it's traditionally much more disgusting. It's a cesspool for men. I don't know what's worse than a cesspool for women.
Thank you for acknowledging that. I will say, in general, my experience on Twitter and Instagram has really been like 99.9% positive. And also, I think people who follow me, you know, they kind of know what they're getting into. Like, I am the person who wants to, you know, post something about kindness. I post about humor. I have a fascination with obscure words. So I might, because I'm a logophile, I might like, you know, start talking about like an odd word that I found, voice acting. So, you know, I don't think I'm usually targeted in that way. Fingers crossed. I am definitely more words than pictures. So I'm pretty active on Twitter. I've gotten a lot better on Instagram with the pictures. And please feel free to follow and communicate with me. It's Julie_Nathanson on both. And I love being able to interact with fans. It's really fun. People share their fan art with me. I fangirl over their fan art, which is actually true, because I am not a visual artist. My stick figures look like chickens. So, not healthy chickens. So my social media experience has been positive. I have had, I would say, one experience, with those platforms, that did give me a front row view, to the other side of it. And, it's not pretty. I don't think I'll ever really understand the interest, the passion for sort of converging on a person and sort of making a negative experience, you know, trolling or attacking. And I've certainly seen it happen to friends of mine. And, you know, it's really unfortunate. It's also, it's not why any of us does this. You know, I recently read Stephen King's book on writing. Because I also have another life as a writer as well. And there's a quote that, like, I can't stop thinking about it, which is, and if you can do it for joy, you can do it forever. And that is it to me.
Wow.
That is it. And it's true for writing, and it's true for performance. And really, to me, you know, so many of us got into the creative arts because of love, because of passion, and because of play. And if you hold on to that joy, if you hold on to that space, you really can do it forever. Does it mean that your career is successful and flourishes? I don't know. Again, that's not my business to assess. But can you approximate it? Can you keep playing? Absolutely. And so that, to me, is why I'm in this world, because in the world of entertainment and storytelling, because I want to keep playing and I want to feel that joy. So if I encounter something that has that negativity or, you know, an attack, or I, you know, can tell someone's displeased about something, I, I generally do my best to acknowledge, you know, this is where this person is. You know, I'm sad and sorry that this is the energy that they're holding right now. And, you know, it doesn't match why I do this. I do this stuff because of joy. So I'm going to hold on to that space. And as long as I can keep coming back to that core, then I think that stays my force field. And I hope it stays that way.
Well, you know, you stole my thunder. You gave out your social media handle. So the only thing I can then say is if there's anything in this podcast that you heard that you disagree with, do me a favor, reach out to Julie directly and leave me out of it.
Oh, really? Is that what we're doing?
That's how you survive 245 episodes.
No, come on. Share the non-love. No, please feel free to reach out. And I do try to respond. And I really do. I like the fact that social media has allowed me to be able to, you know, get a sense of what's important to people and connect. You know, it's all about accessibility anyway, right? I'm not interested in being an inaccessible person by nature. So being able to interact with fans all over the world is pretty special.
Well, the movie Batman: The Long Halloween is out on Blu-ray and it's out on digital and it's coming out on Blu-ray. You can see the film. It is brilliant. But what it did was it introduced me to the lovely and talented Julie Nathanson. Julie, this has been an honor. And you know, it's funny. I knew this was going to be a good episode because when does a voiceover person ever come on and suck? It never happens, but you are enlightening and thank you so much. Your insights are brilliant and please come back to the show.
Oh, thank you. That's so lovely. And I would love to come back to the show. This has really been a pleasure and thank you for asking such, you know, intriguing questions. I appreciate that very much.
We tried, and I didn't even get to ask about Sophia the First. And my daughter is going to be like, you had her on and didn't ask her about Sophia the First? I'm like, listen, that is the great Julie Nathanson. Thank you for listening, everyone. Thank you for subscribing. Remember, rate, review, and mention Julie's name in the review. We will continue to put out a show each and every Thursday. Thanks for listening to the Hall of Justice. Believe it or not, I'm walking on.